Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So this is the second lecture, chapter 20. Chapter 20 is on international finance. And I'm going to start here at about slide 21. And slide 21 says, what is a payment surplus? Now we're talking about international finance and international trade here, right? So we're talking about the United States in relation to the rest of the world. And so if we have a payment surplus, that means more money's coming in to the country than going out. And a payments deficit is that we've got more money going out than coming in. Now we're talking about a payments. Payments surplus or a payments deficit is the total amount of money leaving or entering. Now a part of that total is the balance of trade. Balance of trade says if we buy from foreigners, money goes out. If foreigners buy from us, money comes in. Now, what is the problem, or what could be the problem of too much money coming in? Now, we're not talking about for a short time, but if a lot more money is coming in than going out over a period of time, what could be the problem? Inflation. That's the answer. Because what causes inflation? Inflation is caused by an increase in the money supply more than we increase goods and services. Essentially, we talked about the quantity theory of money and MB equals PQ, but the simple quantity theory of money simply says if the money supply increases more than goods and services increase, that can cause inflation. Now, what could be the problem of too much money leaving or us having an unfavorable balance of payments? And too much money going out can cause unemployment. Where is the equilibrium? The equilibrium is where the total amount of money coming in equals the total money going out. Remember, the equilibrium means a tendency toward. So in other words, if we have a problem of too much money coming in, then the system will correct itself, and before too long, the situation will be reversed. Now, how come? Let's say this. Let's say we got too much money coming in. Now, what's going to happen that's going to reverse this trend? You just got to think about it logically. Here's America. Here's the rest of the world. As more dollars leaves the rest of the world and comes into America, what is happening to the supply of dollars on the international market? It decreases, right? More of those dollars enter the country, there's fewer of those dollars on the international market, correct? When the supply decreases of anything, what happens to the value or to the price? Goes up. Now, if the value of the dollar goes up, what happens to our ability to buy from foreigners? It's cheaper. See, now, when we say the value goes up, when you're talking about international finance, it's always in relation to other countries. Or if you're talking about the American dollar, it's always in relation to other countries' currencies. If more money is coming in than going out, more dollars is coming in than going out, a decrease in the supply of dollars in the international market, the value of the dollar therefore goes up. We therefore can buy more from foreigners, and foreigners therefore can buy less from us because their currencies now are worth less relative to the dollar. So as we buy more from them and they buy less from us, then the whole process is reversed. So let's say that we've got a problem of too much money going out. Now again, if we've got too much money going out over a period of time, that's going to cause unemployment, right? But what's going to happen? Without us doing anything, what's going to happen? Well, as more dollars enter the international market, what happens to the supply of dollars on the international market? Goes up. What happens to the value of the dollar relative to other currencies? It decreases. As the value decreases, our ability to buy from foreigners goes down. Foreigners' ability to buy from us goes up. They buy more from us, we buy less from them, and now the flow of money is reversed. See, now we got more money coming in and less money going out. So, see, at what point are we always tending toward? We're always tending toward a point where the amount of money entering equals the amount of money leaving. See, that is an equilibrium. See, that the beauty in the system is that it is self-adjusting. See, notice here that we didn't have to do anything. The system was self-adjusting. Well, I got ahead of myself here. Let's look at these slides. When can a payment surplus be a problem? If it is too favorable over time, it can cause inflation. Slide 22. What is a payments deficit? Now, there are different terms here. Payments deficit would be the same thing as an unfavorable balance of payments. A payment surplus, another way of saying it, would be a favorable balance of payments. See, very often in economics, we use different terms to say the same thing. So a payments deficit, of course, is when there is more money leaving a country than there is entering a country. And when can a payments deficit be a problem? Okay, if we can have unemployment. When is there a balance in the balance of payments? When the amount of money entering equals the amount of money leaving, and that is an equilibrium. This is always a point that we're tending toward. Okay, so how are balance of payments problems resolved? With a lot more money entering over time, currency will appreciate. Appreciate means, you know, increase in value. With a lot more money leaving over time, a currency will depreciate. So this is what I was just talking about here in slide 26. So what is the merchandise trade balance? The value of merchandise exported minus the value of merchandise imported. And what the point here is that the merchandise trade balance is a part of the balance of payments. So sometimes we talk about a favorable balance of trade, unfavorable balance of trade, or trade deficit, trade surplus, and here we're only measuring merchandise. But that's only a part of the total flow of money in and out. See, a favorable balance of trade, the value of a country's imports of goods is less than the value of its exports of goods. And unfavorable balance of trade, I've talked about. Let's see. Now, how can a money leave or enter a country? Well, these are the different ways that we've talked about other than trade, investments, travel, sending gifts, things of that nature. Can the balance of payments offset the balance of trade? Money can leave a country because of trade, but more money can enter the country in other areas. In other words, can we have an unfavorable balance of trade but a favorable balance of payments? Can we buy more from foreigners than they buy from us, and therefore more money leaves the country via trade, but yet have a favorable balance of payments? Well, yeah, that's possible. I mean, if more money enters the country in these other ways, other than trade, then we can have an unfavorable balance of trade, but still have a favorable balance of payments. How does foreign trade affect GDP? An increase in exports increases GDP, and a decrease in exports decreases GDP. Now, in this, we always follow the money. Okay, so see, if we have an increase in exports, what's happening to the flow of money? Well, more money's entering the country. And as more money enters the country, that increases GDP. If we buy from foreigners more than they buy from us, that's money leaving, and that tends to decrease our GDP. Now, what is the gold standard? Now, what we're going to do here is talk about our international monetary system. We're talking about a system whereby countries can cooperate and trade with one another and pay for the trade. We are not on the gold standard, but we do talk about the gold standard because we compare it to what we are doing today. Plus, it's historically, at one time, we were on the gold standard, and it may happen again. It used to be that we would peg the dollar to gold, but that's not really the gold standard. Now, the gold standard here existed from about 1879 to about 1914. What's significant about 1914? World War One. You know, World War One was about from 1914 to 1918, and so from 1879 to World War One, the international financial system operated under the gold standard. Now, what that meant is that not only did we peg our currencies to gold, but we actually paid for our merchandise from one country to another in gold. Now, when you pay another country in gold, does that mean that you put gold on an airplane or a ship and transport that gold to another country? Now, see, we can be on the gold standard, and that gold need not move at all. And the reason is that all we have to do is change ownership. See, gold can be in a central location, and let's say that we buy from somebody else and we pay for that merchandise in gold. Well, all we have to do is take X amount of gold in this central location and say, well, instead of us owning this gold, now you own this gold. See what I mean? So you can make payments in gold without gold ever moving. That's the way trade was done, up to the World War One. Okay, so what is one advantage of the gold standard? Any increase in the money supply would be limited to a country's gold holdings. What backs up our money today?
Faith.
Yeah, I mean, it's not backed up by gold and silver, right? It's. I mean, our money has value because you can use our money. It's useful and relatively scarce, and you can use it to buy things that we, produce in America, right? I mean, that's what gives the dollar value. But now, what is the danger in our present system as opposed to the gold standard? See, under the gold standard, could we increase the money supply at will? No. See, then under the gold standard, you can't increase the money supply unless you increase your gold holdings. But in our system, since we're not on the gold standard, we're not on any standard, the danger is that we could greatly increase the money supply more than we increase goods and services. Now, if we do not, if we only increase the money supply to the extent that we increase goods and services, then does it make any difference if we're on the gold standard or not? And the answer is, well, not really. I mean, it really doesn't make any difference. See, the danger is a potential danger. The danger in not being on any standard is that people in authority, for one reason or another, could greatly increase the money supply, and that would cause inflation. Now, what are we doing presently? How is a good portion of this bailout program under the Obama administration in 2009 being paid for? A lot of it's borrowed money, and a lot of it is taxpayers' money. A lot of it is, well, created money. Now, you said printed money, and sometimes we talk about printing money in the way of creating money, but what is most of our money? Is it in the terms of Federal Reserve notes? Now, what is our money? Our money is simply what?
Digitized.
Right, that's a good way of putting it. Just an electronic impulse. See, this is where the term monetizing the debt comes in. The federal government can sell securities to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve can simply push a few keys on the computer, credit the government's account by X billions of dollars, and the government spends that money, and the money supply increases. And where did that money come from? Nowhere, from out of thin air. Now, if we are presently doing that, and if we do it enough over a period of time, what's this going to cause? Inflation. And by the way, how would that inflation benefit the government? Now, the government's borrowing money, right? Now, how does the borrower benefit from inflation? Yeah, see, with inflation, it's possible that the borrower can pay back less money than they borrowed in real terms. Somebody lends you money, and you say, well, I'll pay you 5% over a period of time, let's say 3 years. But over that same period of time, inflation's, let's say, a 15%. Well, when you pay them back, you're actually paying them back 10% less in real terms. So you, as a borrower, actually gain from this inflation. You actually pay back less money than you borrow. Of course, the lender is hurt by this, right? The lender is getting back less money than they lent out. But sometime what I'm saying is that governments will actually want to cause inflation because this is a nice, neat little way of absolving their debt. They can pay back their debt in depreciated dollars and get the debt paid off, and it really not pay, you know, cost them too much. Of course, again, it's always the lenders that are hurt. What was that one thing that tripped, pushed us over the limit and forced Chrysler into bankruptcy? Well, it all had to do with lenders and borrowers. That's why I mentioned it. Because one of the agreements that was trying to be imposed on the situation by the government was that the bondholders, the people who lent General Motors money, part of the agreement was they would only accept 33 cents on a dollar. In other words, they lend a dollar and they'll get back 33 cents. And according to law, bondholders should be paid first. But according to the agreement, the unions and the government were ahead of the bondholders. And the bondholder says, we don't want to accept this. We're getting shafted here. And so they couldn't come to an agreement, and so what happened? Well, now it's up to a judge. See, it was thrown in bankruptcy court, which was a big mistake by the government, because now the government has lost control. And now a judge that has had a lot of experience in this and is happens to be a very good judge is going to judge quite differently than would have been the case if the government could have come to an agreement before bankruptcy. But I'm talking about this only because we're talking about lenders and borrowers and the effects of economics on them. Okay, anyway, what is, did America honor payment in gold after World War I? Yes, if countries demanded payment for goods and services in gold, we would pay in gold. What happened to this practice of paying in gold? During the Depression of the 1930s, foreigners demanded payment in gold, thus depleting our gold supply. And what did we do about this? In 1932, what did President Herbert Hoover do? Now, the problem is, we're on the gold standard, depression starts here, the rest of the world's getting concerned, and they're saying, we want our gold. We don't want to keep our gold in America, we want to take it out of America and put it someplace safer. What did we do? How do we encourage those foreigners to keep their gold here instead of taking it home? Well, we decreased the money supply. Now, what was the purpose of decreasing the money supply? Interest rate. Now, not decrease it, but increase it, right? Yeah. We decreased the money supply. See, what effect can we have on interest rates? Well, interest rates in the loanable market, those rates are determined by market forces, meaning the demand and supply of that borrowed money in the market. So, what's the market? Demand and supply. Well, if we decrease the supply of money, what happens to the price of borrowed money? It goes up, or interest rates go up. Now, what's that got to do with foreigners? Well, one incentive for foreigners to keep their money here is to earn interest. And if you raise interest enough, that may overcome their fears. See, and they might say, well, with this higher return that we can make, it compensates us for what we view as a heightened risk. But unfortunately, what did that do by decreasing the money supply? What did that do to our economy? Yeah, see, it made our unemployment problem worse. I mean, if our unemployment problem, if the root cause was insufficient demand, and we decrease the money supply, what happens to demand? Well, it goes down even more, and the problem gets worse. See, remember, I talked about earlier that what happened in the 20s led to the growing unemployment in the early 30s, but what really caused a depression are three government policies, right? And one of those policies was decreasing the money supply in 1932. So anyway, what happened to this practice of paying in gold? During the depression of the 1930s, foreigners demanded payment in gold, thus depleting our gold supply. Slide 38, when did the gold standard end? During World War I, the gold standard collapsed, limiting trade during the 20s and 30s. And what is a fixed exchange rate system? The value of each currency was pegged to an ounce of gold. Now, this is not a gold system here, but it's a fixed exchange rate system that we established in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944. In other words, we said we have to have some way of determining the value of each country's currency relative to other countries' currencies in order to facilitate trade. I mean, how can you trade with other countries if you don't know what your currency is worth relative to their currency? So you can't carry on a trade with that insufficient knowledge, with uncertainty. So what we did in 1944 is we said, look, let's let each country peg their currency to an ounce of gold. And so America said, well, it would take so many dollars to buy an ounce of gold. And England said, well, it takes so many pounds to buy an ounce of gold. And Germany said, well, it would take so many marks to buy an ounce of gold. See, this is before the euro existed, right? So, I'm talking about marks in Germany and pounds in England. And, of course, I think England still uses pounds. But anyway, now, if each country pegged their currency to gold and said, well, it takes so much of our currency to buy an ounce of gold, then we would know what each currency was worth relative to other countries' currencies. Now, that's called a fixed international exchange rate system. This system worked very well until the early 70s. Now, what happened in the early 70s that made this system unworkable? What's the decade of the 70s characterized by? Stagflation. The 70s was a decade of high rates of inflation and growing unemployment. In fact, we had to invent the word stagflation in the 70s just to explain the situation because it had never happened before. See, before this, if we had growing unemployment, we normally had declining prices. And if we had inflation, we tended to have full employment. But never did we have both increasing unemployment and increasing inflation at the same time. Now, by the way, what was the cause of that? What was the cause of stagflation?
Oil.
Okay, because the price of oil greatly increased in the early 70s, and because unions bargained for large pay raises larger than their increase in productivity, and unions back then were more powerful. I mean, they made up a larger percent of the workforce than is the case today. So those two things did what? They raised costs on businesses, right? And so what did businesses have to do to make up for the increase in costs? Increase their prices. Now, if you look at demand and supply, if costs go up, what's going to happen to the supply curve? If you owned a business and your costs went up, what would happen to your ability to supply? Goes down, right? You can't supply as much at those higher costs than at lower costs. Now, if the aggregate supply curve shifts to the left, what happens to prices? No, goes up. Aggregate supply curve shifts to the left, prices go up, GDP goes down, and what is that? Stagflation. Now we get higher prices and increase in unemployment at the same time. Now, what's this got to do with this? What we're really talking about here? What's this got to do with this? These fixed exchange rates. 1944, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Each country pegs their currency to gold. Everyone knows what their currency is worth relative to other countries. This facilitates trade. Now, in the 70s, what's the problem? When we have now, the average annual inflation rate in the 70s was about 10% a year. What happens to the value of the dollar when prices increase 10%? Goes down. Let's say that each of us here represented different countries. I have inflation rate of 10% a year. You have inflation rate of 10% a year. All of us have inflation rate of 10% a year. Is that going to cause any problems? No. How come? Yeah, because it doesn't change relative to one another in terms of our country's currency, doesn't change anything. But what happens if we in America have a 10% inflation rate, England has a 18% inflation rate, Germany has a 3% inflation rate? See what I mean? I mean, what happens when these countries have greatly, you know, different rates of inflation? As each country has different rates of inflation, what happens to the real value of each of those countries' currencies? It's changing in accordance to their inflation rate, correct? Well, now, therefore, what is happening to the value of each of our currencies relative to one another? It's greatly changing, right? So how can we trade assuming that the values of our currencies are fixed relative to one another? That's why the system became unworkable. It became too divorced from reality. See, this happens sometime in our economies. What's one of the big reasons for our economic collapse here in the past 6 months? The root cause of our economic meltdown is because of a mathematical formula. In fact, the name of that mathematical formula is called the Black-Scholes formula. Now, what is the Black-Scholes formula? Banks take mortgages in. They sell those mortgages to investment companies, like hedge funds, investment banks. Those financial institutions combine these mortgages, like maybe 10,000 mortgages, into one debt instrument called a CDO, or collateralized debt obligation. And then they divide this instrument into different, what are called shanks, different parts, and then they sell these pieces off piecemeal to investors. Now, here's the point. If you've got a CDO that's made up of, let's say, 10,000 mortgages, or maybe it's even more than mortgages. I mean, you can throw anything in there you want. You can throw credit cards in there. You can throw, car loan there. I mean, it could be anything. But it's all part of one package. You divide it all up into tranches. It's called tranches. You sell them off piecemeal. There's all kinds of different situations in that those 10,000 debt instruments. You know, some people are defaulting, some aren't, some are slow payment, some this, some that. What is the value of that CDO? Now, this CDO is worth, I mean, it's made up of, let's say, 10,000 different debt instruments, like mortgages. What's the value? Can the market determine the value? See, it's impossible to determine the value of this thing. So how can we trade these and sell these things? Well, that's where the formula comes in. We all agree that these CDOs have this value in accordance to the Black-Scholes formula. And we trade based on that formula. But eventually, what happens? Well, when people started to default on their mortgages as they were pushed over the edge, banks had to actually sell these CDOs in the market. They found that these CDOs were worthless because no one would buy them because the market couldn't put any value on them. In other words, what I'm saying here is that what we were doing was based on a formula, but that formula became totally so far away from reality that it collapsed. And that's why we've got this meltdown, I mean, a big part of it. Now, that's what happened with the fixed exchange rate system. See, we had a fixed exchange rate system, and each country was trading with one another, assuming what? Assuming that their currencies were fixed relative to one another. But that system became what? That system became divorced from reality. Just as in today's situation, the Black-Scholes formula became so divorced from reality that the whole system collapsed. The same thing happened back in the early 70s. The exchange rate system that we traded upon totally collapsed because it became divorced from reality. So what did we do as a result? If the system we were using was no longer workable, what system did we replace it with that was workable? The system that we replaced it with in the early 70s was the freely flexible international exchange rate system. In other words, what we said is, let's not have any standard. Let's simply let the market determine the value of different countries' currencies. And then we'll trade based on those values. It's called a freely flexible international exchange rate system, where the forces of demand and supply of that country's currency on the international market will determine the value of that country's currency. Now, I'm sure I got way ahead of myself here, so let me see what these slides give us. When was the fixed exchange rate system? From 1945 to about 1973. See, by 1973, it became obvious that, hey, this system that we're basing our trade on is not working. It's too divorced from reality. And Bretton Woods was 1944. All foreign exchange rates were fixed in terms of the dollar, and the dollar could be converted to gold at a fixed exchange rate. Under the Bretton Woods Agreement, how much did we agree to exchange foreign holdings of? Well, what we said back in 1944 is that it'd take $35 to buy an ounce of gold. That was our standard. And England said take so many pounds, and Germany said take so many marks, and France said it would take so many francs. You see, that was a fixed exchange rate system. And in 1944, what is a currency devaluation? An increase in the official peg price of foreign exchange in terms of the domestic currency. So what we're now saying is that even though the system under the fixed exchange rate system, starting 1944 to 1973, even though it was a fixed exchange rate system, it was possible to change the standard, each country's standard, up to a certain point. In other words, we said $35 to buy an ounce of gold. Well, it was possible for us to change that. But we couldn't change it a lot. We could change it a little bit. And if we wanted to change it more than a certain amount, then we had to get the agreement of all other members, other nations. So it was possible. So it wasn't fixed in stone. In other words, yes, you know, we pegged our currencies to gold, but that wasn't fixed in stone. It was somewhat flexible, but only somewhat flexible. See, how flexible is our present system? Our present system is 100% flexible. See, it's very flexible. It's just, well, what, you know, market for, you know, we don't, no standard. We don't set anything. Just let the market determine the value. See, that's very flexible. Now, this fixed exchange rate system, it really wasn't a fixed exchange rate system. It was a relatively fixed exchange rate system. In other words, it was fixed at any point in time, but we could change it. You know, we could say, well, it takes, you know, we might say, well, now it might take $38 by an ounce of gold. Or we could lower it, depending upon the situation. Say, well, now it would take $32 by an ounce of gold. So, I mean, we could change that fixed ratio there. But when the situation in the 70s became so dire, those minor changes that we could make under this relatively fixed system weren't enough. I mean, the things were happening so quick, and different countries were having such greatly different inflation rates that we couldn't make these changes quick enough to keep up with events. And so finally, we just threw in the towel and said, "Hey, we can't do this any longer. This is not possible. Let's not even try. Let's just throw our cares to the wind and not try to intervene at all, and just let the system let the market determine values." Do we use the Black-Scholes formula any longer to determine the value of these CDOs? No. I mean, we had to throw that out the window. We said, well, this is so divorced from reality, because really, things really only have value based on the market, ultimately. A lot of the banks, you know, on the books, they said, well, we have one, you know, let's say $10 million worth of CDOs. That's our assets. But if we try to sell them in the market, we can't hardly get maybe 5 cents on a dollar for it. And that's why banks are going bankrupt. And, of course, what are we doing to prevent a total banking collapse? We're simply giving them money. We're giving them literally trillions of dollars. Billions, anyway. Close to a trillion, but, you know, several billions of dollars we're giving the banks so they don't go under. And, of course, what's changed over the past 2 to 3 years that made it necessary, or at least the government thought it was necessary, for us to bail out the banks? On purpose, what's happened over the past 2 or 3 years is that banks have merged, and so that we've got a lot fewer banks today, but the banks that we have are much larger. And so those larger banks went to Washington, D.C. and said, "Hey, look, we're too big to fail. So you've got to give us money." Okay, what is the currency revaluation? Well, that, I think it's a reduction in the official peg price of foreign exchange in terms of domestic currency. In other words, we can depreciate, under the fixed exchange rate system, we could depreciate a currency or appreciate a currency. Now, today, we use the same terms, by the way. Today, the market forces may dictate a lower value of the dollar relative to the euro, and we would say, well, the dollar is depreciated relative to the euro. Or the market forces may increase the value of the dollar relative to the euro, and so we might say that the dollar has appreciated relative to the euro. I mean, do people make money by simply playing the different valuations of different countries' currencies on the international market? I mean, can you buy one currency, and if the value of that currency that you bought goes up relative to the one that you gave, you know, that you bought with originally, then you could exchange back, and you would gain that way. Anyway, we're going to talk about that too. What is the International Monetary Fund? It helps facilitate exchange rates by allowing countries to trade currencies. Originally, the International Monetary Fund was a fund, an entity that was financed by different countries. Different countries would put in money States put in a large amount of money, you know, Germany, England, and then the IMF would be a fund or an entity that would help other countries in if they have problems of either being out of balance one way or the other. In other words, if they had a too favorable balance of payments or too unfavorable balance of payments, they could borrow money from the International Monetary Fund, or they could exchange their currency for other currencies, and the International Monetary Fund was meant to kind of even out these wide, otherwise it might be wide swings of valuations between different countries. Now, the system that we're in today, another way of saying it is that our currencies are allowed to float, but there is such a thing as a dirty float. And a dirty float is when we say, okay, countries' currencies are determined by market forces, but we can influence those market forces, meaning either demand or supply. And that's and that the IMF evolved into that system as well, where let's say that we want the value of the dollar to go up. Well, we could go to the International Monetary Fund and borrow money, but not in dollars. We could borrow money in euros, or we could borrow money in pounds or Japanese yen. And then we could take these currencies and do what with them? Well, we can go around the world and exchange these currencies for dollars. Now, what's happening to the demand of the dollar on the international market? It's going up. See, what's happening to the supply of these other currencies that we borrow from the IMF on the international market? Well, the supply of those currencies are going up because we're taking those currencies and we're putting them into the system and taking dollars out of the system. So what happens to the value of the dollar? It goes up. What happens to the value of other currencies? They go down. So we say, yes, we're going to let the market determine the value of our country's currencies, but with a dirty float, we reserve the right to influence those market forces. And that's the system we have today. See, when was the IMF established? In 1944, same time as Bretton Woods. How does the IMF help countries influence? See, if the U.S. wants to devalue the dollar, it will borrow dollars from the IMF and buy other currencies around the world. If the U.S. wants to revalue the dollar, meaning, want the value of the dollar to go up, then it will borrow other currencies from the IMF and buy dollars around the world. And what was the advantage of the fixed-rate system? Each country knew what its currency was worth in relation to foreign currencies. What happened to the fixed exchange rate system? The inflation in the 70s led to a change in the value of all currencies, a wide difference in the values. So the system became divorced from reality. Are major currencies still fixed? No. Major currencies today are allowed to fluctuate in value according to market forces. Now, major currencies. Are all currencies in our present system allowed to float? No. Major currencies float, and many minor currencies peg the value of their currency to a major currency. It may be the dollar, or maybe the euro, or maybe the yen. But we got hundreds of countries in the world, and it would be too much if all of them, the value of all of them changed according to market forces. So what we have is the major currencies change in accordance to market forces, and then minor currencies simply follow suit, depending upon which currency they've chosen to peg theirs to, whether it be the dollar or the euro, etc. What is it called when currencies are allowed to fluctuate? It is called floating. Well, there's a dirty float. A dirty float occurs when a country influences the demand and or supply of its currency on the international market. Slide 54. Now, I talked about a dirty float in relative to the IMF, the International Exchange Rate System. I mean, the IMF. But there are we don't have to use the IMF in order to do this. I mean, you know, we can simply take dollars that we already have, like in the U.S. Treasury, for example, and go around the world and buy other currencies. I mean, demand is demand, and supply is supply. See, what is a managed float system? An exchange rate system that combines features of a freely flexible rates with intervention by central banks. And that's what we have today. We have a managed float system. See, a managed float system. Slide 57. Foreign exchange rates tend toward equality around the world because of actions of arbitrageurs. And what is an arbitrageur? A person who takes advantage of differences in exchange rates by purchasing in one market and selling in another market. Now, is this good or bad? Well, it's really good. See, because of arbitrageurs, the system is runs very smoothly. And because it's once there are differences, before those differences can be too acute, arbitrageurs will take advantage of those differences, and it just makes the whole system run more smoothly. I mean, more smoothly in reference to perhaps being less erratic. You know, where the changes that take place are minimized because of arbitrageurs, because, you know, the system is freely flexible. You know, once there becomes an imbalance in the system, well, that imbalance is brought back to balance very quickly, because partly because of arbitrageurs. Now, who is a speculator? A person who buys or sells foreign exchange in hopes of profiting from fluctuations in exchange rate over time. So what is the difference between a speculator and an arbitrageur? An arbitrageur buys and sells simultaneously, whereas a speculator does it over time. In other words, a speculator might be one where, you know, there are banks, like there's the Ever Bank, where you can open up an account and decide what currency you want to keep your money in. So like you might open up an account and say, well, I want to keep my money, you know, I'll send you $5,000 or $10,000, but I don't want to keep that in dollars. I want you to hold it in euros. Now, you're not actively engaged in buying and selling on a daily basis based on, you know, your expectations of what's going to happen tomorrow, but you're simply parking your money there over a longer period of time in hopes that maybe over the next 6 months the euro will appreciate relative to the dollar, so that when you take your money out, the difference will be a gain to you. And that's what's called a speculator. See? Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that at all. In fact, with EverBank, what you can do is you can, if you've got $10,000, you can buy a CD in any currency you want. So let's say that you take $10,000 and you buy a CD in euros. And a CD pays you, let's say, 7% over, let's say, a year. But in that year's time, the euro goes up 3% relative to the dollar. So when you cash in your CD, how much do you gain? You gain 10% instead of 7%. So, you know, this is a way of taking advantage of... Of course, it can go the other way, right? You can take $10,000 and put it into a CD in euros, but if the value of the euro goes down 3% relative to the dollar, then instead of gaining 7%, you'd only gain 4%. See, so I mean, no one can tell the future for sure, right? But I mean, if you, I mean, there are people that, you know, do things like this. That you know, this is a way that John Maynard Keynes made his fortune. In fact, John Maynard Keynes made his fortune in the international exchange rate, you know, the market. He was able to look ahead and say, well, over the next 6 months, I think the value of the mark is going to go up relative to the English pound. So he would take English pounds and buy German marks. And if you're right more than you're wrong. Now, in investing, do you have to be right 100% of the time to make money? No, you don't have to be right 51% of the time in order to make a gain, right? You don't have to be right more than you're wrong. I mean, it's like investing in the stock market. I mean, you know, no one can always buy it low and sell high. But if you, you know, but if you buy near the low and sell near the high, you're still going to make a lot of money. Oh, wow, that's the end. Any questions about any of this? Okay, so we'll call it a day. And this ends the semester.